everything. Didn't she do everything for him, cook, sew, and keep house, as their mother used to? Wasn't she the one who had been taking care of the silkworm single-handedly so that he, her smart little brother, could take lessons from the priest, learning ancient Greek? Hadn't she been the one to say, "You take care of the books, I'll take care of the cocoonery, all you have to do is sell the cocoons at the market"? And when he had started lingering down in the city, had she complained? Had she mentioned the scraps of paper, or his red eyes, or the musky sweet smell on his clothes? Desdemona had a suspicion that her dreamy brother had become a hashish smoker. Where there was Rebetika music, there was always hashish. Lefty was dealing with the loss of their parents in the only way he could, by disappearing in a cloud of hash smoke while listening to the absolutely saddest music in the world. Desdemona understood all this, and so had said nothing. But now she saw that her brother was trying to escape his grief in a way she hadn't expected, and she was no longer content to be quiet. "You want a woman?" Desdemona asked in an incredulous voice. "What kind of woman? A Turkish woman?" Lefty said nothing. After his outburst, he had resumed combing his hair. "Maybe you want a harem girl, is that right? You think I don't know about those types of loose girls, those putanis? Yes, I do. I'm not so stupid. You like a fat girl shaking her belly in your face with a jewel in her fat belly. You want one of those. Let me tell you something. Do you know why those Turkish girls cover their faces? You think it's because of religion? No, it's because otherwise no one can stand to look at them." And now she shouted, "Shame on you, Eleftherios. What's the matter with you? Why don't you get a girl from the village?" It was at this point that Lefty, who was now brushing off his jacket, called his sister's attention to something she was overlooking. "Maybe you haven't noticed," he said, "but there aren't any girls in this village." Which, in fact, was pretty much the case. Vithynios had never been a big village, but in 1922 it was smaller than ever. People had begun leaving in 1913 when the Phylloxera blight ruined the currents. They had continued to leave during the Balkan Wars. Lefty and Desdemona's cousin, Sormelina, had gone to America and was living now in a place called Detroit. Built along a gentle slope of the mountain, Vithynios wasn't a precarious cliffside sort of place. It was an elegant, or at least harmonious, cluster of yellow stucco houses with red roofs. The grandest houses, of which there were two, had sigma enclosed bay windows that hung out over the street. The poorest houses, of which there were many, were essentially one-room kitchens. And then there were houses like Desdemona and Lefty's, with an overstuffed parlor, two bedrooms, a kitchen, and a backyard privy with a European toilet. There were no shops in Vithynios, no post office or bank, only a church and one taverna. For shopping, you had to go into Bursa, walking first and then taking the horse-drawn streetcar. In 1922, there were barely 100 people living in the village. Fewer than half of those were women. Of 47 women, 21 were old ladies, another 20 were middle-aged wives, 3 were young mothers, each with a daughter in diapers, 1 was his sister. That left 2 marriageable girls, whom Desdemona now rushed to nominate. "What do you mean there aren't any girls? What about Lucille Kafkalas? She's a nice girl. Or Victoria Pappas?" "Lucille smells," Lefty answered reasonably. "She bathes maybe once a year on her name day. And Victoria..." He ran a finger over his upper lip. "Victoria has a mustache bigger than mine. I don't want to share a razor with my wife." With that, he put down his clothing brush and put on his jacket. "Don't wait up," he said, and left the bedroom. "Go!" Desdemona called after him. "See what I care? Just remember, when your Turkish wife takes off her mask, don't come running back to the village!" But Lefty was gone. His footsteps faded away. Desdemona felt the mysterious poison rising in her blood again. She paid no attention. "I don't like eating alone," she shouted to no one. The wind from the valley had picked up, as it did every afternoon. It blew through the open windows of the house. It rattled the latch on her hope chest and her father's old worry beads lying on top. Desdemona picked the beads up. She began to slip them one by one through her fingers, exactly as her father had done, and her grandfather and her great-grandfather, performing a family legacy of precise, codified, thorough worrying. As the beads clicked together, Desdemona gave herself up to them. What was the matter with God? Why had he taken her parents and left her to worry about her brother? What was she supposed to do with him? Smoking, drinking, and now worse. And where does he get the money for all this foolishness? From my cocoons. That's how. Each bead slipping through her fingers was another resentment recorded and released. Desdemona, with her sad eyes, her face of a girl forced to grow up too fast, worried with her beads, like all the Stefanides men before and after her, right down to me, if I count. She went to the window and put her head out, heard the wind rustling in the pine trees and the white birch. She kept counting her worry beads, and little by little, they did their job. She felt better. She decided to go on with her life. Lefty wouldn't come back tonight. Who cared? Who needed him anyway? It would be easier for her if he never came back. But she owed it to her mother to see that he didn't catch some shameful disease. Or worse, run off with a Turkish girl. The beads continued to drop one by one through Desdemona's hands. But she was no longer counting her pains. Instead, the beads now summoned to her mind images in a magazine, hidden in their father's old desk. One bead was a hairstyle, the next bead was a silk slip, the next was a black brassiere. My grandmother had begun to matchmake. Lefty, meanwhile, carrying a sack of cocoons, was on his way down the mountain. When he reached the city, he came down Kapali Karsi Kadasi, turned at Borsa Sokak, and soon was passing through the arch into the courtyard of the Koza Han. Inside, around the aquamarine fountain, hundreds of stiff, waist-high sacks foamed over with silkworm cocoons. Men crowded everywhere, either selling or buying. They had been shouting since the opening bell at 10 that morning, and their voices were hoarse. Good price! Good quality! Lefty squeezed through the narrow paths between the cocoons, holding his own sack. He had never had any interest in the family livelihood. He couldn't judge silkworm cocoons by feeling or sniffing them, as his sister could. The only reason he brought the cocoons to market was that women were not allowed. The jostling, the bumping of porters and sidestepping of sacks made him tense. He thought how nice it would be if everyone would just stop moving a moment, if they would stand still to admire the luminosity of the cocoons in the evening light. But, of course, no one ever did. They went on yelling and thrusting cocoons in one another's faces and lying and haggling. Lefty's father had loved market season at the Koza Han, but the mercantile impulse hadn't been passed down to his son. Near the covered portico, Lefty saw a merchant he knew. He presented his sack. The merchant reached deep into it and brought out a cocoon. He dipped it into a bowl of water and then examined it. Then he dipped it into a cup of wine. Oh, I need to make organzine from these. They're not strong enough. Lefty didn't believe this. Desdemona's silk was always the best. He knew that he was supposed to shout, to act offended, to pretend to take his business elsewhere. But he had gotten such a late start. The closing bell was about to sound. His father had always told him not to bring cocoons late in the day because then you had to sell them at a discount. Lefty's skin prickled under his new suit. He wanted the transaction to be over. He was filled with embarrassment, embarrassment for the human race, its preoccupation with money, its love of swindle. Without protest, he accepted the man's price. As soon as the deal was completed, he hurried out of the Koza Han to attend to his real business in town. It wasn't what Desdemona thought. Watch closely. Lefty, setting his derby at a rakish angle, walks down the sloping streets of Bursa. When he passes a coffee kiosk, however, he doesn't go in. The proprietor hails him, but Lefty only waves. In the next street, he passes a window behind whose shutters female voices call out, but he pays no attention, following the meandering streets past fruit sellers and restaurants until he reaches another street, where he enters a church, more precisely, a former mosque, with minaret torn down and Quranic inscriptions plastered over to provide a fresh canvas for the Christian saints that are even now being painted on the interior. Lefty hands a coin to the old lady selling candles, lights one, stands it upright in sand. He takes a seat in a back pew, and in the same way my mother will later pray for guidance over my conception, Lefty Stefanides, my great uncle, among other things, gazes up at the unfinished Christ Pantocrator on the ceiling. His prayer begins with words he learned as a child. Kyrie eleison, Kyrie eleison, I am not worthy to come before thy throne. But soon it veers off, becoming personal with, I don't know why I feel this way. It's not natural. And then turning a little accusatory, praying, You made me this way. I didn't ask to think things like... But getting abject finally with, Give me strength, Christos, don't let me be this way. If she even knew... Eyes squeeze shut. Hands bending the derby's brim, the words drifting up with the incense toward a Christ in progress. He prayed for 5 minutes, then came out, replaced his hat on his head, and rattled the change in his pockets. He climbed back up the sloping streets, and this time his heart unburdened, stopped at all the places he'd resisted on his way down. He stepped into a kiosk for coffee and a smoke. He went to a cafe for a glass of ouzo. The backgammon player shouted, Hey, Valentino, how about a game? He let himself get cajoled into playing, just won, then lost, and had to go double or nothing. The calculations Desdemona found in Lefty's pants pockets were gambling debts. The night wore on, the ouzo kept flowing, the musicians arrived, then the rabitaka began. They played songs about lust, death, prison, and life on the street. At the hash den on the seashore where I'd go every day, Lefty sang along, every morning bright and early to chase the blues away. I ran into 2 harem girls sitting on the sand, quite stoned the poor things were, and they were really looking grand. Meanwhile, the hookah was being filled. By midnight, Lefty came floating back onto the streets. An alley descends, turns, dead ends, a door opens, a face smiles, beckoning. The next thing Lefty knows, he's sharing a sofa with 3 Greek soldiers looking across at 7 plump, perfumed women sharing 2 sofas opposite. A phonograph plays the hit song that's playing everywhere, every morning, every evening. And now his recent prayer is forgotten completely because, as the madam says, Anyone you like, sweetheart. Lefty's eyes pass over the blonde, blue-eyed Circassian and the Armenian girl suggestively eating a peach and the Mongolian with the bangs. His eyes keep scanning to fix on a quiet girl at the end of the far couch, a sad-eyed girl with perfect skin and black hair in braids. There's a scabbard for every dagger, the madam says in Turkish as the whores laugh. Unconscious of the workings of his attraction, Lefty stands up, smooths his jacket, holds out his hand toward his choice, and only as she leads him up the stairs does a voice in his head point out how this girl comes up to exactly where... And isn't her profile just like... But now they've reached the room with its unclean sheets, its blood-colored oil lamp, its smell of rose water and dirty feet. In the intoxication of his young senses, Lefty doesn't pay attention to the growing similarities the girl's disrobing reveals. His eyes take in the large breasts, the slim waist, the hair cascading down to the defenseless kakix. But Lefty doesn't make connections. The girl fills a hookah for him. Soon he drifts off, no longer hearing the voice in his head. In the soft hashish dream of the ensuing hours, he loses sense of who he is and who he's with. The limbs of the prostitute become those of another woman. A few times he calls out a name, but by then he's too stoned to notice. Only later, showing him out, does the girl bring him back to reality. By the way, I'm Irini. We don't have a Desdemona here. The next morning, he awoke at the Cocoon Inn, awash in recriminations. He left the city and climbed back up the mountains to Vithinios, his pockets empty, made no sound. Hungover and feverish, Lefty told himself that his sister was right. It was time for him to get married. He would marry Lucille, or Victoria, He would have children and stop going down to Bursa, and little by little he'd change, he'd get older. Everything he felt now would fade into memory and then into nothing. He nodded his head. He fixed his hat. Back in Vithynios, Desdemona was giving those two beginners finishing lessons. While Lefty was still sleeping it off at the Cocoon Inn, she invited Lucille Kapkalis and Victoria Pappas over to the house. The girls were even younger than Desdemona, still living at home with their parents. They looked up to Desdemona as the mistress of her own home. Envious of her beauty, they gazed admiringly at her. Flattered by her attentions, they confided in her, and when she began to give them advice on their looks, they listened. She told Lucille to wash more regularly, and suggested she use vinegar under her arms as an antiperspirant. She sent Victoria to a Turkish woman who specialized in removing unwanted hair. Over the next week, Desdemona taught the girls everything she'd learned from the only beauty magazine she'd ever seen, a tattered catalog called Lingerie Parisienne. The catalog had belonged to her father. It contained 32 pages of photographs showing models wearing brassieres, corsets, garter belts, and stockings. At night, when everyone was sleeping, her father used to take it out of the bottom drawer of his desk. Now Desdemona studied the catalog in secret, memorizing the pictures so she could recreate them later. She told Lucille and Victoria to stop by every afternoon. They walked into the house, swaying their hips as instructed, and passed through the grape arbor where Lefty liked to read. They wore a different dress each time. They also changed their hairstyles, walks, jewelry, and mannerisms. Under Desdemona's direction, the two drab girls multiplied themselves into a small city of women, each with a signature laugh, a personal gemstone, a favorite song she hummed. After 2 weeks, Desdemona went out to the grape arbor one afternoon and asked her brother, "What are you doing here? Why aren't you down in Bursa? I thought you had found a nice Turkish girl to marry by now, or do they all have mustaches like Victoria's?" "Funny you should mention that," Lefty said. "Have you noticed? Vicky doesn't have a mustache anymore. And do you know what else? Getting up now, smiling. Even Lucille's starting to smell okay. Every time she comes over, I smell flowers." He was lying, of course. Neither girl looked or smelled more appealing to him than before. His enthusiasm was only his way of giving in to the inevitable. An arranged marriage, domesticity, children. The complete disaster. He came up close to Desdemona. "You were right," he said. "The most beautiful girls in the world are right here in this village." She looked shyly back up into his eyes. "You think so?" "Sometimes you don't even notice what's right under your nose." They stood gazing at each other as Desdemona's stomach began to feel funny again. And to explain the sensation, I have to tell you another story. In his presidential address at the annual convention of the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality in 1968, held that year in Mazatlan, among lots of suggestive piñatas, Dr. Luce introduced the concept of parafescence. The word itself means nothing. Luce made it up to avoid any etymological associations. The state of parafescence, however, is well known. It denotes the first fever of human pair bonding. It causes giddiness, elation, a tickling on the chest wall, the urge to climb a balcony on the rope of the beloved's hair. Parafescence denotes the initial drugged and happy bedtime, where you sniff your lover like a scented poppy for hours running. It lasts, Luce explained, up to 2 years tops. The ancients would have explained what Desdemona was feeling as the workings of Eros. Now expert opinion would put it down to brain chemistry and evolution. Still, I have to insist, to Desdemona, parafescence felt like a lake of warmth flooding up from her abdomen and across her chest. It spread like the 180-proof fiery flood of a mint-green Finnish liqueur. With the pumping of two efficient glands in her neck, it heated her face. And then the warmth got other ideas and started spreading into places a girl like Desdemona didn't allow it to go. And she broke off the stare and turned away. She walked to the window, leaving the pair of pheasants behind, and the breeze from the valley cooled her down. "I will speak to the girl's parents," she said, trying to sound like her mother. "Then you must go pay court." The next night, the moon, like Turkey's future flag, was a crescent. Down in Bursa, the Greek troops scrounged for food, caroused, and shot up another mosque. In Angora, Mustafa Kemal let it be printed in the newspaper that he would be holding a tea at Chankaya, while in actuality he'd left for his headquarters in the field. With his men, he drank the last raki he'd taken till the battle was over. Under cover of night, Turkish troops moved not north towards Eskişehir, as everyone expected, but to the heavily fortified city of Afyon in the south. At Eskişehir, Turkish troops lit campfires to exaggerate their strength. A small diversionary force feinted northward toward Bursa, and amid these deployments, Lefty Stefanides, carrying two corsages, stepped out the front door of his house and began walking to the house where Victoria Pappas lived. It was an event on the level of a birth or a death. Each of the nearly 100 citizens of Vithynios had heard about Lefty's upcoming visits, and the old widows, the married women, and the young mothers, as well as the old men, were waiting to see which girl he would choose. Because of the small population, the old courting rituals had nearly ceased. This lack of romantic possibility had created a vicious cycle. No one to love, no love, no love, no babies, no babies, no one to love. Victoria Pappas stood half in and half out of the light, the shading across her body exactly that of the photograph on page 8 of Lingerie Parisienne. Desdemona, costume lady, stage manager, and director all in one, had pinned up Victoria's hair, letting ringlets fall over her forehead and warning her to keep her biggish nose in shadow. Perfume, depilated, moist with emollients, wearing coal around her eyes, Victoria let Lefty look upon her. She felt the heat of his gaze, heard his heavy breathing, heard him try to speak twice, small squeaks from a dry throat. And then she heard his feet coming toward her, and she turned, making the face Desdemona had taught her. But she was so distracted by the effort to pout her lips like the French lingerie model that she didn't realize the footsteps weren't approaching, but retreating, and she turned to see that Lefty Stefanides, the only eligible bachelor in town, had taken off. Meanwhile, back at home, Desdemona opened her hope chest. She reached in and pulled out her own corset. Her mother had given it to her years ago in expectation of her wedding night, saying, "I hope you feel this out some day." Now before the bedroom mirror, Desdemona held the strange, complicated garment against herself. Down went her knee socks, her gray underwear. Off came her high-waisted skirt, her high-collared tunic. She shook off her kerchief and upbraided her hair so that it fell over her bare shoulders. The corset was made of white silk. As she put it on, Desdemona felt as though she were spinning her own cocoon, awaiting metamorphosis. But when she looked in the mirror again, she caught herself. It was no use. She would never get married. Lefty would come back tonight, having chosen a bride, and then he would bring her home to live with them. Desdemona would stay where she was, clicking her beads and growing even older than she already felt. A dog howled. Someone in the village kicked over a bundle of sticks and cursed. And my grandmother wept silently, because she was going to spend the rest of her days counting worries that never went away. While in the meantime, Lucille Kafkalis was standing, exactly as she'd been told, half in and half out of the light, wearing a white hat sashed with glass cherries, a mantilla over bare shoulders, a bright green décolleté dress, and high heels, in which she didn't move for fear of falling. Her fat mother waddled in, grinning and shouting, "Here he comes! Even 1 minute he couldn't stay with Victoria!" Already he could smell the vinegar. Lefty had just entered the low doorway of the Kafkalis house. Lucille's father welcomed him and said, "We'll leave you two alone to get acquainted." The parents left. It was dim in the room. Lefty turned and dropped another corsage. What Desdemona hadn't anticipated, her brother, too, had pored over the pages of Lingerie Parisienne. In fact, he'd done it from the time he turned 12 to the time he turned 14, when he discovered the real loot, 10 postcard-sized photographs hidden in an old suitcase showing Sermine, girl of the pleasure dome, in which a bored, pear-shaped 25-year-old assumed a variety of positions on the tasseled pillows of a stage seraglio. Finding her in the toiletries pocket was like rubbing a genie's lamp. Up she swirled in a plume of shining dust, wearing nothing but a pair of Arabian night slippers and a sash around her waist. Flash! Lying languidly on a tiger skin, fondling a scimitar. Flash! And bathing, lattice-lit, at a marble hammam. Those 10 sepia-tone photographs were what had started Lefty's fascination with the city. But he had never entirely forgotten his first loves in lingerie parisienne. He could summon them in his imagination at will. When he had seen Victoria Pappas looking like page 8, what had struck Lefty most acutely was the distance between her and his boyhood ideal. He tried to imagine himself married to Victoria, living with her, but every image that came to mind had a gaping emptiness at the center. The lack of the person he loved more and knew better than any other. And so he had fled from Victoria Pappas to come down the street and find Lucille Kafkalis just as disappointingly failing to live up to page 22. And now it happens. Desdemona, weeping, takes off the corset, folds it back up, and returns it to the Hope chest. She throws herself on the bed, Lefty's bed, to continue crying. The pillow smells of his lime pomade, and she breathes it in, sobbing. Until, drugged by weeping's opiates, she falls asleep. She dreams the dream she's been having lately. In the dream, everything's the way it used to be. She and Lefty are children again, except they have adult bodies. They're lying in the same bed, except now it's their parents' bed. They shift their limbs in sleep, and it feels extremely nice how they shift, and the bed is wet. At which point Desdemona wakes up, as usual. Her face is hot. Her stomach feels funny, way deep down. And she can almost name the feeling now. As I sit here in my Erin chair, thinking E.O. Wilson thoughts, was it love or reproduction, chance or destiny, crime or nature at work? Maybe the gene contained an override ensuring its expression, which would explain Desdemona's tears and Lefty's taste in prostitutes. Not fondness, not emotional sympathy, only the need for this new thing to enter the world, and hence the heart's rigged game. But I can't explain it, any more than Desdemona or Lefty could have, any more than each one of us falling in love can separate the hormonal from what feels divine. And maybe I cling to the God business out of some altruism, hardwired to preserve the species. I can't say. I try to go back in my mind to a time before genetics, before everyone was in the habit of saying about everything, oh, it's in the genes. A time before our present freedom, and so much freer. Desdemona had no idea what was happening. She didn't envision her insides as a vast computer code, all ones and zeros, an infinity of sequences, any one of which might contain a bug. Now we know we carry this map of ourselves around. Even as we stand on the street corner, it dictates our destiny. It brings onto our faces the same wrinkles and age spots our parents had. It makes us sniff in idiosyncratic, recognizable family ways. Genes embedded so deep, they control our eye muscles, so that two sisters have that same way of blinking, and boy twins dribble in unison. I feel myself sometimes, in anxious moods, playing with the cartilage of my nose exactly as my brother does. Our throats and voice boxes form from the same instructions, press air out in similar tones and decibels. And this can be extrapolated backward in time, so that when I speak, Desdemona speaks too. She's writing these words now. Desdemona, who had no idea of the army inside her, carrying out its million orders, or of the one soldier who disobeyed, going AWOL. Running like Lefty away from Lucille Kafkalis and back to his sister. She heard his feet hurrying as she was refastening her skirt. She wiped her eyes with her kerchief and put a smile on as he came through the door. So which one did you choose? Lefty said nothing, inspecting his sister. He hadn't shared a bedroom with her all his life, not to be able to tell when she'd been crying. Her hair was loose, covering most of her face, but the eyes that looked up at him were brimming with feeling. Neither one, he said. At that, Desdemona felt tremendous happiness. But she said, what's the matter with you? You have to choose. Those girls look like a couple of whores. Lefty, it's true. You don't want to marry them? No. You have to, she held out her fist. If I win, you marry Lucille. Lefty, who could never resist a bet, made a fist himself. 1, 2, 3, shoot! Axe breaks rock, Lefty said. I win. Again, said Desdemona. This time if I win, you marry Vicky. 1, 2, 3! Snake swallows Axe. I win again. So long to Vicky. Then who will you marry? I don't know. Taking her hands and looking down at her. How about you? Too bad I'm your sister. You're not only my sister. You're my third cousin, too. Third cousins can marry. You're crazy, Lefty. This way will be easier. We won't have to rearrange the house. Joking but not joking, Desdemona and Lefty embraced. At first, they just hugged in the standard way, but after 10 seconds, the hug began to change. Certain positions of the hands and strokings of the fingers weren't the usual displays of sibling affection, and these things constituted a language of their own, announced a whole new message in the silent room. Lefty began waltzing Desdemona around, European style. He waltzed her outside, across the yard, over to the cocoonery, and back under the grape arbor, and she laughed and covered her mouth with her hand. You're a good dancer, cousin, she said, and her heart jumped again, making her think she might die right then and there in Lefty's arms. But of course she didn't. They danced on. And let's not forget where they were dancing, in Vithynios. That mountain village where cousins sometimes married third cousins, and everyone was somehow related, so that as they danced, they started holding each other more tightly, stopped joking, and then just danced together as a man and a woman in lonely and pressing circumstances might sometimes do. And in the middle of this, before anything had been said outright or any decision made, before fire would make those decisions for them, right then, mid-waltz, they heard explosions in the distance and looked down to see, in firelight, the Greek army in full retreat. An immodest proposal. Descended from Asia Minor Greeks, born in America, I live in Europe now. Specifically in the Schönberg district of Berlin. The Foreign Service is split into two parts, the diplomatic corps and the cultural staff. The ambassador and his aides conduct foreign policy from the newly opened, extensively barricaded embassy on Neustadtische Kirchstraße. Our department, in charge of readings, lectures, and concerts, operates out of the colorful concrete box of America House. This morning, I took the train to work as usual. The U-Bahn carried me gently west from Kleistpark to Berliner Straße, and then after a switch, northward toward Zoologischer Garten, stations of the former West Berlin passed one after another. Most were last remodeled in the 70s and have the colors of suburban kitchens from my childhood. Avocado, cinnamon, sunflower yellow. At Spickernstrasse, the train halted to conduct an exchange of bodies. Out on the platform, a street musician played a teary Slavic melody on an accordion. Wingtips gleaming, my hair still damp, I was flipping through the Frankfurter Allgemeine when she rolled her unthinkable bicycle in. You used to be able to tell a person's nationality by the face. Immigration ended that. Next, you discerned nationality via the footwear. Globalization ended that. Those Finnish seal puppies, those German flounders, you don't see them much anymore. Only Nikes on Basque, on Dutch, on Siberian feet. The bicyclist was Asian, at least genetically. Her black hair was cut in a shag. She was wearing a short olive-green windbreaker, flared black ski pants, and a pair of maroon campers resembling bowling shoes. The basket of her bike contained a camera bag. I had a hunch she was American. It was the retro bike, chrome and turquoise. It had fenders as wide as a Chevrolet's, tires as thick as a wheelbarrow's, and appeared to weigh at least 100 pounds. An expatriate's whim, that bike. I was about to use it as a pretext for starting a conversation when the train stopped again. The bicyclist looked up. Her hair fell away from her beautiful hooded face, and for a moment, our eyes met. The placidity of her countenance, along with the smoothness of her skin, made her face appear like a mask, with living human eyes behind it. These eyes now darted away from mine as she grasped the handlebars of her bike and pushed her great two-wheeler off the train and toward the elevators. The U-Bahn resumed, but I was no longer reading. I sat in my seat in a state of voluptuous agitation, of agitated voluptuousness, until my stop. Then I staggered out. Unbuttoning my suit jacket, I took a cigar from the inner pocket of my coat. From a still smaller pocket, I took out my cigar cutter and matches. Though it wasn't after dinner, I lit the cigar, a Davidoff Grand Cru No. 3, and stood smoking, trying to calm myself. The cigars, the double-breasted suits, they're a little too much. I'm well aware of that, but I need them. They make me feel better. After what I've been through, some overcompensation is to be expected. In my bespoke suit, my checked shirt, I smoked my medium-fat cigar until the fire in my blood subsided. Something you should understand. I'm not androgynous in the least. 5-alpha-reductase deficiency syndrome allows for normal biosynthesis and peripheral action of testosterone in utero, neonatally, and at puberty. In other words, I operate in society as a man. I use the men's room. Never the urinals, always the stalls. In the men's locker room at my gym, I even shower. Albeit discreetly. I possess all the secondary sex characteristics of a normal man, except one. My inability to synthesize dehydrotestosterone has made me immune to baldness. I've lived more than half my life as a male, and by now everything comes naturally. When Calliope surfaces, she does so like a childhood speech impediment. Suddenly, there she is again, doing a hair flip or checking her nails. It's a little like being possessed. Callie rises up inside me, wearing my skin like a loose robe. She sticks her little hands into the baggy sleeves of my arms. She inserts her chimp's feet through the trousers of my legs. On the sidewalk, I'll feel her girlish walk take over, and the movement brings back a kind of emotion, a desolate and gossipy sympathy for the girls I see coming home from school. This continues for a few more steps. Calliope's hair tickles the back of my throat. I feel her press tentatively on my chest, that old nervous habit of hers, to see if anything is happening there. The sick fluid of adolescent despair that runs through her veins overflows again into mine. But then, just as suddenly, she is leaving, shrinking and melting away inside me. And when I turn to see my reflection in a window, there's this. A 41-year-old man, with longish wavy hair, a thin mustache, and a goatee. A kind of modern musketeer. But that's enough about me for now. I have to pick up where explosions interrupted me yesterday. After all, neither Cal nor Calliope could have come into existence without what happened next. I told you, Desdemona cried at the top of her lungs. I told you all this good luck would be bad. This is how they liberate us. Only the Greeks would be so stupid. By the morning after the waltz, you see, Desdemona's forebodings had been borne out. The Megalaithia had come to an end. The Turks had captured Afyon. The Greek army, beaten, was fleeing toward the sea. In retreat, it was setting fire to everything in its path. Desdemona and Lefty, in dawn's light, stood on the mountainside and surveyed the devastation. Black smoke rose from miles across the valley. Every village, every field, every tree was aflame. "We can't stay here," said Lefty. "The Turks will want revenge. Since when did they need a reason? We'll go to America. We can live with Somalina." "It won't be nice in America," Desdemona insisted, shaking her head. "You shouldn't believe Lena's letters. She exaggerates." "As long as we're together, we'll be okay." He looked at her, in the way of the night before, and Desdemona blushed. He tried to put his arm around her, but she stopped him. "Look." Down below, the smoke had thinned momentarily. They could see the roads now, clogged with refugees. A river of carts, wagons, water buffalo, mules, and people, hurrying out of the city. "Where can we get a boat? In Constantinople?" "We'll go to Smyrna," said Lefty. "Everyone says Smyrna's the safest way." Desdemona was quiet for a moment, trying to fathom this new reality. Voices rumbled in the other houses as people cursed the Greeks, the Turks, and started packing. Suddenly, with resolve, "I'll bring my silkworm box and some eggs so we can make money." Lefty took hold of her elbow and shook her arm playfully. "They don't farm silk in America." "They wear clothes, don't they? Or do they go around naked? If they wear clothes, they need silk, and they can buy it from me." "Okay, whatever you want. Just hurry." Eleftherios and Desdemona Stephanides left Vithinios on August 31, 1922. They left on foot, carrying two suitcases packed with clothes, toiletries, Desdemona's dream book and worry beads, and two of Lefty's texts of ancient Greek. Under her arm, Desdemona also carried her silkworm box containing a few hundred silkworm eggs wrapped in a white cloth. The scraps of paper in Lefty's pockets now recorded not gambling debts, but forwarding addresses in Athens or Astoria. Over a single week, the hundred or so remaining citizens of Athenios packed their belongings and set out for mainland Greece, most en route to America. A diaspora which should have prevented my existence, but didn't. Before leaving, Desdemona walked out into the yard and crossed herself in the Orthodox fashion, leading with the thumb. She said her goodbyes to the powdery, rotting smell of the cocoonery and to the mulberry trees lined along the wall, to the steps she'd never have to climb again, and to this feeling of living above the world, too. She went inside the cocoonery to look at her silkworms for the last time. They had all stopped spinning. She reached up, plucked a cocoon from a mulberry twig, and put it in her tunic pocket. On September 6, 1922, General Hagiannistis, commander-in-chief of the Greek forces in Asia Minor, awoke with the impression that his legs were made of glass. Afraid to get out of bed, he sent the barber away, foregoing his morning shave. In the afternoon, he declined to go ashore to enjoy his usual lemon ice on the Smyrna waterfront. Instead, he lay on his back, still and alert, ordering his aides, who came and went with dispatches from the front, not to slam the door or stomp their feet. This was one of the commander's more lucid, productive days. When the Turkish army had attacked Afyon 2 weeks earlier, Hagiannistis had believed that he was dead, and that the ripples of light reflecting on his cabin walls were the pyrotechnics of heaven. At 2 o'clock, his second-in-command tiptoed into the general's cabin to speak in a whisper. "Sir, I am awaiting your orders for a counterattack, sir." "Do you hear how they squeak?" "Sir, my legs, my thin, vitreous legs." "Sir, I am aware the general is having trouble with his legs, but I submit, with all due respect, sir," a little louder than a whisper now, "this is not a time to concentrate on such matters." "You think this is some kind of joke, don't you, Lieutenant? But if your legs were made of glass, you'd understand. I can go into shore That's exactly what Kamal is banking on, to have me stand up and shatter my legs to pieces. These are the latest reports, General. His second-in-command held a sheet of paper over Hagi Anistis' face. The Turkish cavalry has been sighted 100 miles east of Smyrna, he read. The refugee population is now 180,000. That's an increase of 30,000 people since yesterday. I didn't know death would be like this, Lieutenant. I feel close to you. I'm gone. I've taken the trip to Hades. Yet I can still see you. Listen to me. Death is not the end. This is what I've discovered. We remain. We persist. The Dead Sea, that I'm one of them. They're all around me. You can't see them, but they're here. Mothers with children, old women. Everyone's here. Tell the cook to bring my lunch. Outside, the famous harbor was full of ships. Merchant vessels were tied up to a long quay alongside barges and wooden caiques. Farther out, the Allied warships lay at anchor. The sight of them, for the Greek and Armenian citizens of Smyrna and the thousands and thousands of Greek refugees, was reassuring, and whenever a rumor circulated. Yesterday, an Armenian newspaper had claimed that the Allies, eager to make amends for their support of the Greek invasion, were planning to hand the city over to the victorious Turks. The citizens looked out at the French destroyers and British battleships still on hand to protect European commercial interest in Smyrna, and their fears were calmed. Dr. Nishan Filibosian had set off for the harbor that afternoon seeking just such reassurance. He kissed his wife, Tuki, and his daughters, Rose and Anita, goodbye. He slapped his sons, Karakin and Stepan, on the back, pointing at the chessboard and saying with mock gravity, "Don't move those pieces." He locked the front door behind him, testing it with his shoulder, and started down Suyani Street, past the closed shops and shuttered windows of the Armenian Quarter. He stopped outside Baburian's bakery, wondering whether Charles Baburian had taken his family out of the city or whether they were hiding upstairs like the Filibosians. For 5 days now, they'd been under self-imprisonment, Dr. Filibosian and his sons playing endless games of chess, Rose and Anita looking at a copy of photoplay he'd picked up for them on a recent visit to the American suburb of Paradise, Tuki cooking day and night, because eating was the only thing that relieved the anxiety. The bakery door showed only a sign that said "Open Soon," and a portrait which made Filibosian wince of Kemal, the Turkish leader, resolute in Astrakhan cap and fur collar, his blue eyes piercing beneath the crossed sabers of his eyebrows. Dr. Filibosian turned away from the face and moved on, rehearsing all the arguments against putting up Kemal's portrait like that. For one thing, as he'd been telling his wife all week, the European powers would never let the Turks enter the city. Second, if they did, the presence of the warships in the harbor would restrain the Turks from looting. Even during the massacres of 1915, the Armenians of Smyrna had been safe. And finally, for his own family at least, there was the letter he was on his way to retrieve from his office. So reasoning, he continued down the hill, reaching the European quarter. Here the houses grew more prosperous. On either side of the street rose two-story villas with flowering balconies and high armored walls. Dr. Filibosian had never been invited into these villas socially, but he often made house calls to attend the Levantine girls living inside, girls of 18 or 19, who awaited him in the water palaces of the courtyards, lying languidly on daybeds amid a profusion of fruit trees, girls whose desperate need to find European husbands gave them a scandalous amount of freedom, cause itself for Smyrna's reputation as being exceptionally kind to military officers, and responsible for the fever blushes the girls betrayed on the mornings of Dr. Filibosian's visits, as well as for the nature of their complaints, which ran from the ankle twisted on the dance floor to more intimate scrapes higher up. All of which the girls showed no modesty about, throwing open silk peignoirs to say, "It's all red, doctor, do something. I have to be at the Cassine by 11. These girls, all gone now, taken out of the city by their parents after the first fighting weeks ago, off in Paris and London, where the season was beginning, the houses quiet as Dr. Filibosian passed by, the crisis receding from his mind at the thought of all those loosened robes. But then he turned the corner, reaching the quay, and the emergency came back to him. From one end of the harbor to the other, Greek soldiers, exhausted, cadaverous, unclean, limped toward the embarkation point at Kesme, southwest of the city, awaiting evacuation. Their tattered uniforms were black with soot from the villages they'd burned in retreat. Only a week before, the waterfront's elegant open-air cafes had been filled with naval officers and diplomats. Now the quay was a holding pen. The first refugees had come with carpets and armchairs, radios, Victrolas, lampstands, dressers, spreading them out before the harbor under the open sky. The more recent arrivals turned up with only a sack or a suitcase. Amid this confusion, porters darted everywhere, loading boats with tobacco, figs, frankincense, silk, and mohair. The warehouses were being emptied before the Turks arrived. Dr. Philobosian spotted a refugee picking through chicken bones and potato peels in a heap of garbage. It was a young man, in a well-tailored but dirty suit. Even from a distance, Dr. Philobosian's medical eye noticed the cut on the young man's hand and the pallor of malnutrition. But when the refugee looked up, the doctor saw only a blank for a face. He was indistinguishable from any of the refugees swarming the quay. Nevertheless, staring into this blankness, the doctor called, "Are you sick?" "I haven't eaten for 3 days," said the young man. The doctor sighed. "Come with me." He led the refugee down back streets to his office. He ushered him inside and brought gauze, antiseptic, and tape from a medical cabinet and examined the hand. The wound was on the man's thumb, where the nail was missing. How did this happen? "First the Greeks invaded," the refugee said. "Then the Turks invaded back. My hand got in the way." Dr. Philobosian said nothing as he cleaned the wound. "I'll have to pay you with a check, doctor," the refugee said. "I hope you don't mind. I don't have a lot of money on me at the moment." Dr. Philobosian reached into his pocket. "I have a little. Go on, take it." The refugee hesitated only a moment. "Thank you, doctor. I'll repay you as soon as I get to the United States. Please give me your address." "Be careful what you drink." Dr. Philobosian ignored the request. "Boil water if you can. God willing, some ships may come soon." The refugee nodded. "You're Armenian, doctor?" "Yes. And you're not leaving? Shmirne is my home." "Good luck, then. And God bless you." "You too." And with that, Dr. Philobosian led him out. He watched the refugee walk off. It's hopeless, he thought. He'll be dead in a week, if not typhus, something else. But it wasn't his concern. Reaching inside a typewriter, he extracted a thick wad of money from beneath the ribbon. He rummaged through drawers until he found, inside his medical diploma, a faded, typewritten letter. "This letter is to certify that Nishan Philobosian, M.D., did on April 3, 1919, treat Mustafa Kemal Pasha for diverticulitis. Dr. Philobosian is respectfully recommended by Kemal Pasha to the esteem, confidence, and protection of all persons to whom he may present this letter." The bearer of this letter now folded it and tucked it into his pocket. By then the refugee was buying bread at a bakery on the quay, where now, as he turns away, hiding the warm loaf under his grimy suit, the sunlight off the water brightens his face and his identity fills itself in. The aquiline nose, the hawk-like expression, the softness appearing in the brown eyes. For the first time since reaching Smyrna, Lefty Stefanidis was smiling. On his previous forays, he'd brought back only a single rotten peach and 6 olives. Which he'd encouraged Desdemona to swallow, pits and all, to fill herself up. Now carrying the sesame-seeded hureki, he squeezed back into the crowd. He skirted the edges of open-air living rooms where families sat listening to silent radios and stepped over bodies he hoped were sleeping. He was feeling encouraged by another development, too. Just that morning, word had spread that Greece was sending a fleet of ships to evacuate refugees. Lefty looked out at the Aegean. Having lived on a mountain for 20 years, he'd never seen the sea before. Somewhere over the water was America and their cousin Somalina. He smelled the sea air, the warm bread, the antiseptic from his bandaged thumb. And then he saw her, Desdemona, sitting on the suitcase where he'd left her, and felt even happier. Lefty couldn't pinpoint the moment he'd begun to have thoughts about his sister. At first, he'd just been curious to see what a real woman's breasts looked like. It didn't matter that they were his sister's. He tried to forget that they were his sister's. Behind the hanging kalimi that separated their beds, he saw Desdemona's silhouette as she undressed. It was just a body. It could have been anyone's. Or Lefty liked to pretend so. "What are you doing over there?" Desdemona asked, undressing. "Why are you so quiet?"
"I'm reading."
"What are you reading?"
"The Bible."
"Oh, sure. You never read the Bible." Soon he found himself picturing his sister after the lights went out. She'd invaded his fantasies. But Lefty resisted. He went down to the city instead, in search of naked women he wasn't related to. But since the night of their waltz, he'd stopped resisting. Because of the messages of Desdemona's fingers, because their parents were dead and their village destroyed, because no one in Smyrna knew who they were, and because of the way Desdemona looked right now, sitting on a suitcase. And Desdemona, what did she feel? Fear, foremost, and worry, punctuated by unprecedented explosions of joy. She had never rested her head in a man's lap before while riding in an ox cart. She'd never slept like spoons encircled by a man's arms. She'd never experienced a man getting hard against her spine while trying to talk as though nothing were happening. "Only 50 more miles," Lefty had said one night on the arduous journey to Smyrna. "Maybe we'll be lucky tomorrow and get a ride, and when we get to Smyrna, we'll get a boat to Athens." His voice, tight, funny-sounding, a few tones higher than normal. "And from Athens, we'll get a boat to America. Sound good? Okay, I think that's good." What am I doing? Desdemona thought. He's my brother. She looked at the other refugees on the quay, expecting to see them shaking their fingers, saying, "Shame on you." But they only showed her lifeless faces, empty eyes. Nobody knew, nobody cared. Then she heard her brother's excited voice as he lowered the bread before her face. "Behold, manna from heaven." Desdemona glanced up at him, her mouth filled with saliva as Lefty broke the horeki in two. But her face remained sad. "I don't see any boats coming," she said. "Oh, they're coming. Don't worry. Eat." Lefty sat down on the suitcase beside her. Their shoulders touched. Desdemona moved away. "What's the matter?"
"Nothing.
Every time I sit down, you move away." He looked at Desdemona, puzzled, but then his expression softened. And he put his arm around her. She stiffened. "Okay, have it your way." He stood up again.
"Where are you going?"
"To find more food."
"Don't go," Desdemona pleaded. "I'm sorry. I don't like sitting here all alone."
But Lefty had stormed off. He left the quay and wandered the city streets, muttering to himself. He was angry with Desdemona for rebuffing him, and he was angry at himself for being angry at her, because he knew she was right. But he didn't stay angry long. It wasn't in his nature. He was tired, half-starved. He had a sore throat, a wounded hand. But for all that, Lefty was still 20 years old, on his first real trip away from home, and alert to the newness of things. When you got away from the quay, you could almost forget that there was a crisis on. Back here, there were fancy shops and high-toned bars still operating. He came down the Rue de France and found himself at the sporting club. Despite the emergency, two foreign consuls were playing tennis on the grass courts out back. In fading light, they moved back and forth, swatting the ball, while a dark-skinned boy in a white jacket held a tray of gin and tonics courtside. Lefty kept walking. He came to a square with a fountain and washed his face. A breeze came up, bringing the smell of jasmine all the way in from Bonabat. And while Lefty stops to breathe it in, I'd like to take this opportunity to resuscitate, for purely elegiac reasons and only for a paragraph, that city which disappeared once and for all in 1922. Smyrna endures today in a few rabbitica songs and a stanza from the wasteland. Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant, unshaven with a pocketful of currants, CIF London, documents at sight, asked me, in demotic French, to luncheon at the Cannon Street Hotel, followed by a weekend at the Metropole. Everything you need to know about Smyrna is contained in that. The merchant is rich, and so was Smyrna. His proposal was seductive, and so was Smyrna, the most cosmopolitan city in the Near East. Among its reputed founders were, first, the Amazon, which goes nicely with my theme, and second, Tantalus himself. Homer was born there, and Aristotle Onassis. In Smyrna, east and west, opera and politakia, violin and zurna, piano and theoli, blended as tastefully as did the rose petals and honey in the local pastries. Lefty started